Welcome to On the Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks, and big bickies. On the Money is coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. On the Money, the buck stops with us. I'm your host, Catherine Zengerer, on the show this week.
The big four banks have more than 80% of market share in anything they do in retail. And what's more, their proportionate shares don't shift very much, which sort of looks a bit like a cosy club rather than healthy and vigorous competition.
We'll take a look at the Murray Inquiry and the missed opportunity to look at increasing competition in Australia's banking sector.
There's a willingness and, you know, to be a part of this, and that they too can see that, you know, they can make a difference in communities in terms of their corporate social responsibilities.
We'll hear from the Aboriginal businessman who's working with government to encourage closer relationships in the Indigenous business sector. And
we connect the dots. So we're connecting talent with opportunities, with investors and capital.
On this week's episode of Start Me Up, Ellen and Josh take a look at how startup incubators and accelerators are helping our entrepreneurs. That's all coming up. You're on the money. The Murray Inquiry into the Australian financial system was the first inquiry in 16 years. Headed by former CEO of the Commonwealth Bank, David Murray, the inquiry's report was handed down in December last year, but it took until October this year and a change of Prime Minister and Treasurer for the government to deliver its response. The inquiry was asked to make recommendations that would ensure our financial system is robust and resilient enough to resist any future financial shocks, such as the 2008 GFC. So David Murray recommended the capital base of Australian banks, in other words the assets they hold, should be increased to what he called an unquestionably strong level, and that there should be a narrower gap in different mortgage lending requirements between institutions. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull agreed, saying the government endorses the regulator APRA and the steps it's taking to make banks shore up their capital. But Rob Nichols from the UNSW Business School says there was a missed opportunity in the review to look at ways to increase competition in the banking sector.
One of the approaches that the government took during the GFC, which is consistent with what happens around the world, is to guarantee the deposits of small depositors, and small means less than about $150,000, so big, small depositors. And that guarantee falls back on you and I as taxpayers. So what the approach is to try and make sure that if there is a failure of a bank, well, firstly, that there isn't a failure, but if there is a failure, the impact on depositors will be small, and therefore the impact on taxpayers will be small. And one way that Murray suggested that that could be done is by the banks putting away some money in case things go wrong. And that is, it's called increasing the capital reserves. So normally the banks borrow a chunk of money from depositors and other places. They lend it, and they lend nearly as much as they borrow. But the buffer in between allows for shocks. So what David Murray said was that the level of capital that banks should hold should go up, and that they should keep that buffer to minimise the risk to you and I.
Now, hasn't the regulator APRA and the Reserve Bank already been forcing banks to increase that capital ratio, and banks have responded with those capital levels going up this year by $16 billion? Is that not enough?
It is enough, but what David Murray suggested is that actually Australia should be in the top 25%. So it's enough for now. It's driven by two things. One is the levels that David Murray suggested, and the second is a set of international agreements known as the Bâle agreements after the place in Switzerland.
Now, that finding of David Murray was disputed by the Banking Association, mm-hmm. wasn't it? They said actually they found that Australia is in the top 25% of banks in terms of capital ratios in the world.
They did, but what David Murray suggested was that they should stay there. So what the Bankers Association said was, well, we are. And what David Murray said is, yes, well, you were when you did those statistics, but you need to stay there. And that means increasing the capital ratio. So what the banks have done is gone out and raised extra money. But they've also, in the last little while, started to increase mortgage rates. So you've seen Westpac increase by 0.2%, Commonwealth by 0.15%.
This is why the Greens are saying the big banks are the winners out of this and the government response, isn't it? That banks and the bank deposit tax was let go by the wayside. There was a risk that that was going to be passed on to consumers anyway, but that the banks are really not having to step up here when it comes to covering themselves against risk of loss.
That's right. So the banks had a choice. They could ask the shareholders to pay or the customers to pay, and they've chosen that it's you and I who pay and not their shareholders. Now, the Bankers Association runs another argument and says, oh, well, all of the superannuation funds are heavily invested in banks, so if it was even the shareholders that were drawn on, so it would affect you and I as well. But as a consumer, I'd rather have the choice to have a lower rate and let my super fund worry about the capital call.
Which brings us to that issue of competition in the sector.
Yes.
Because you could argue that banks can hold this position of being able to not pass on interest rate decreases by the Reserve Bank and being able to pass on some of these costs of capital raising to customers because there is a lack of competition in the sector.
Yes.
What did the Murray Inquiry say in relation to that?
It skirted the issue to some extent. So it said, well, you've got a balance. There's a balance between stability and competition. And broadly, Murray said that the balance is about right. But that about right means that the big four banks have more than 80% of market share in anything they do in retail. And what's more, their proportionate shares don't shift very much, which sort of looks a bit like a cozy club rather than healthy and vigorous competition. And the research work that I was doing with the Centre for International Finance and Regulation came up with a couple of suggestions to improve competition which won't adversely affect stability. And one is pretty simple. It's bank account number portability. That is, just in the same way you can switch your phone providers, you should be able to switch your bank. At the moment, switching the bank is hard. You've got to tell all the direct debits, you've got to get your pay changed, and for the vast majority of people, both here and in other places where people have looked at it, they give up. The other thing is that banks hold a lot of data about us and the way that we bank. It seemed to us, and it's been tried in other jurisdictions, actually, if each one of us was entitled to the lump of data on an anonymous basis that actually showed what we do, we could then use a comparison site to say, well, there's a better bank for you, or you've chosen the right bank. And if you've got low switching costs, low switching times, and the ability to make proper comparisons, that will improve competition at a retail level and doesn't affect stability.
I guess the issue is, in terms of that stability issue, is that smaller lenders are less regulated than the big four banks. So they can more freely choose their funding mix, have lower funding costs, and they can pass that on to the consumers. But the less stringent regulation means that there's more risk there.
But sadly, that's the theory, but in practice it's different. So APRA actually requires a higher capital adequacy. So the smaller banks have to put more capital aside, particularly for mortgages, than the big banks. So even though you might find that an independent bank is offering a lower headline rate, their costs are higher, they're just more efficient in delivering the services. So you'd need some of that regulation to ensure the stability. What we were talking about earlier as to we don't want to call on the taxpayers. But at the moment, the big four banks get treated better than the rest of the sector, and that doesn't seem quite right.
Which is about that perception that any of those banks are too big to fail. Does that come down to that?
It does, and in fact, APRA has found that all of the big four banks are too big to fail. They're domestic, systemically important financial institutions, so they are those potentially too big to fail banks. And that has led to, I think, a little bit of regulatory blind spot. The regulatory focus is on the big banks, and rather than encouraging the smaller and more nimble competitors, it's easier to say, here is the regulatory model for the rest of you, take it or leave it. And the regulatory model is more disadvantageous to those smaller players.
So what would a less regulated sector or a more competitive sector look like? We know that there are things coming up in things like fintechs, peer-to-peer lending,
yes,
and so on. How would allowing those to operate more freely impact on the sector?
Okay, I think the key thing about these disruptors, and although peer-to-peer is one example, actually PayPal with its working capital loan, which doesn't charge any interest, is another area which is quite interesting. There are a number of different product innovations that come from these players. I think one regulatory approach is to say, we'll let those players who are new, we'll keep an eye on them and let them play. But basically, institutions that create money, that is, who can create money by putting money in your account and putting a debit in a loan account, they need to be treated with a higher level of regulation. So you can have peer-to-peer lending. It doesn't create money. It shifts money around. You can have PayPal's innovations, and they do the same type of thing.
Dr. Rob Nichols is a lecturer in the School of Taxation and Business Law at the UNSW Business School. Dr. Nichols was also a research fellow at the Centre for International Finance and Regulation.
On the Money, dishing the dirt on your dough.
On the Money with me, Catherine Zengerer. Indigenous Business Month has just wrapped up, promoting the variety of Indigenous businesses across the country and bringing an Indigenous voice to the table. Eliza Getzey finds out more.
Michelle Evans is a fellow at Melbourne Business School and runs masterclasses for Indigenous business owners in a program called Murra, supporting Indigenous people to increase their business acumen. It's a bit like a startup accelerator for Indigenous businesses that have been running for at least 3 to 4 years. Michelle says this year's graduates were so inspired they wanted to do something bigger to help other Indigenous businesses across the country.
This year's particular group had a bit more, I don't know, spunk. I guess they just really were very kind of challenging of each other and competitive in one way, where they just said, look, we're going to do something. Why don't we, as simply as it is, name October Indigenous Business Month and run a range of events across the country? And believe it or not, you know, they decided this in June and they've pulled it off.
It was the first ever Indigenous Business Month and featured a range of pitch sessions, leadership symposiums, networking events and conferences. The aim was to help connect government and corporate Australia with Indigenous businesses and help them meet the target set by the government's Indigenous procurement policy introduced earlier this year, ensuring at least 3% of procurement comes from Indigenous businesses. The policy is designed to help Indigenous businesses overcome some of the hurdles they face in the business landscape, as Michelle Evans explains.
One of the things we've noticed, and it's not just our research at Melbourne Business School or the research I'm doing with Professor Ian Williamson, but it's research done here at Charles Sturt University that says over 90%, even possibly quite higher than that, but that's really high, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander business people don't get loans.
Michelle Evans says Indigenous business owners have also faced issues like racism, lack of access to credit, and access to the capital required to grow their businesses.
So what we're actually seeing is this kind of group of business owners who are really, you know, struggling out there because they're doing it on their own bat. And you know, we're interested through the Murra program in growing businesses, and what that really is all about is about capital injections. You need more employees. Are you opening up different sort of products or services, or perhaps you're thinking about opening different kind of offices. We've seen some of our Murra alumni businesses kind of grow internationally, for instance. So you're actually looking at this massive leap forward, and you do need capital support in order to kind of get there.
Michelle says business procurement programs like Supply Nation, which helps connect Indigenous businesses to government and the corporate sector, can be really helpful. But sometimes businesses get caught up in trying to shape their business to suit the needs of the program, rather than what suits the needs of their business.
All of these kind of tensions, they're always, how I see it, as both fantastic opportunities, but also they have a dark side to them, or a downside. Or once you make a choice, you're making a choice that changes things for your business.
Michelle Evans, fellow at Melbourne Business School and Program Director for Australia's first Indigenous Business Masterclass program, Murra. Dean Jarrett is this year's recipient of the UTS Fulbright Scholarship, an Indigenous scholarship for postgraduate research. In his PhD, he's looking into the issues of diversity in supply chains and how it can benefit Indigenous businesses and, by extension, Aboriginal communities. Dean says supply diversity is a win-win situation. Procuring a wide range of suppliers means a business avoids putting all their eggs in one basket, and for Indigenous businesses, it gives them more opportunities for their business to grow.
I was part of it. I was lucky enough to be part of a delegation that went to Denver, Colorado in, I think it was 2012 now, and we saw what supply diversity does over there. There's about 20 of us, Aboriginal businesses, and a couple of corporates that came along as well, which is really good. Supply Nation got a group of us together. We went over. We had a look at, like I said, how supply diversity works over there. But it was actually a trade show and a conference. So there's around about 7,000 people in the States that goes to these conferences on an annual basis, and it's a trade show. So, which is something that sort of opened my eyes up to the enormity of what supply chains are diverse. Suppliers can really change the way business can happen. Supply diversity and Supply Nation has its birthplace from there. The government embraced this idea. This was something that was really tangible. It was working in the States. It was something that Michael McLeod and Dougs really advocated for, and the government embraced it.
As well as researching supply diversity, Dean Jarrett runs his own business called Global Professional Services International, or GPSI, providing management consulting services to Indigenous businesses. In particular, he helps corporate and government departments who want to better develop their procurement outcomes with Indigenous business.
So certain departments that are really doing really well at the moment are, you know, departments of like Department of Defence, the Australian Taxation Office, Department of Human Services. They're doing really well in terms of engaging Aboriginal businesses in their supply chain. But there are a lot that aren't doing so well, and there's many, many, many government departments, and they're just three that are doing well, and there's some that aren't. So our business, for example, Global Professional Services International, we provide the service to help those corporate and government departments who aren't doing so well to help them develop their policies and processes around engaging Aboriginal businesses into their agency or firm.
Dean Jarrett says encouraging Indigenous business has a flow-on effect through the whole Indigenous community.
Research tells us also that Aboriginal businesses are 100 times more likely to employ Aboriginal people. So the support of Aboriginal businesses will address, in a sense, the employment issues that we have as well. So and in terms of examples, just Aboriginal business people as examples of in our communities, you know, in my generation, we never saw that. Aboriginal people never owned businesses. We, like I said, people of my generation, our families were you know, parts of the civil rights movements here in Australia, with around land rights and improving the social conditions here. We never saw the role models in terms of in business. We do now.
Michelle Evans says one of the great things about Indigenous Business Month is how it's helping shape people's sense of their identity as business people and as Aboriginal people.
Indigenous entrepreneurs are talking about this opportunity and how they're seeing themselves in terms of their not just their Aboriginal identity, but their all the identities that we kind of straddle in our life. You've seen people feeling a lot more agency, and I actually think this kind of idea around entrepreneurship as a proxy for agency in the Indigenous business space is something that I'm really excited to be writing about, actually, because people are being able to do something. They're being able to motivate not only themselves and their employees, but be a role model. They're being able to lead in this way of doing business.
Eliza Getzey with that report, which features Michelle Evans, Program Director of Australia's first Indigenous Business Masterclass, and UTS Fulbright Scholar Dean Jarrett. You're on The Money. I'm Catherine Zengerer. For the past couple of weeks, we've been looking at the negatives of Australia's tech industry. It's hard to get money, it's hard to hire people, and we have terrible internet. But now we're looking at the positives. In this segment, we look at two programs that are helping entrepreneurs, accelerators and incubators. Ellen Leibeater and Josh Nicholas have more.
What I love about it is that ability to make something out of nothing.
Australian investors are very conservative.
And yes, the culture has been too unforgiving of failure.
If we're saying that the future of society is down this technological path,
I definitely foresee this as being a massive problem.
Start Me Up. The challenges facing Australia's knowledge economy with Josh Nicholas and Ellen Leibeater.
So Ellen, let's say you had a great idea for an app.
Go on.
You convince your rich aunt to fund you and you start coding away.
Okay.
Now what do you do?
Good question. What do you do?
This is the position that many tech founders find themselves in. They might know how to code or have an idea for an awesome app, but they may not be up to scratch on how to start a business.
Well, you can't know everything.
Exactly. So this is where accelerators and incubators come in. They're programs and organizations that help budding tech entrepreneurs start their business.
Let's tackle them one by one. First off, accelerators. They're short programs, maybe running just a couple of weeks, designed to take ideas in one end and spit out business-ready plans at the other.
There are a couple of famous ones. You may have heard of Y Combinator in Silicon Valley. Have you ever used Dropbox or Airbnb? These are just two of the companies that have been through the Y Combinator program.
A few of the entrepreneurs we spoke to wished that they had access to a program like Y Combinator. But there are actually a couple of similar programs in Australia.
One of them is on the Gold Coast. It's called Silicon Lakes. I went to check out their offices.
An accelerator is sort of like a program. So come in one side, go through something like a 12-week program or 20-week program, whatever it is, and it's basically a fast track to launch your business. So usually most accelerators, you enter when you're around ideation to maybe the first few customers, mm-hmm. and you're really looking at product market fit, so making sure that your business is actually viable, solving your business model and your price points and all that sort of things. And usually when you come out the other end, you're sort of investment ready, or you've got good customer acquisition, good traction, or you've fast failed.
This is Aaron Berkby, a co-founder of Silicon Lakes and a serial entrepreneur.
A couple of years ago, Aaron and his co-founders decided to set up Silicon Lakes on the Gold Coast. But Silicon Lakes isn't just an accelerator program. They are also an incubator. So here's Aaron again telling us what an incubator is.
Incubators tend to be more longer-term plays, so they're more spaces with longer-term mentoring and that sort of thing.
So that's more what Silicon Lakes is now. If you walk around their offices, it's precisely what you imagine a tech space would be. Graffiti mural on the wall, lots of young people with headphones on, a bunch of couches, and of course, people playing table tennis. And remember, there are a bunch of these programs all over the place. To give you an idea, just in Sydney alone, there is Slingshot, Blue Chili, 2515, and a bunch more.
But private incubators and accelerators aren't the only programs around to help out tech entrepreneurs. There are also a number of programs attached to universities, such as ATP Innovations in Sydney and the Innovation Centre attached to the University of the Sunshine Coast.
We've talked to Mark Paddenberg, the CEO of the Innovation Centre, a couple of times on this series. On one of our calls, I asked him to quickly tell us what the Innovation Centre offers budding entrepreneurs.
There's two things. One is very much about keeping tech startups and founders from making the most common mistakes that are made by early stage companies, you know, helping them with their finesse, their business plan and their pitch, making them realize that there are some aspects perhaps in their team. They may have some deficits. You know, the founder quite often is not the right person to be the CEO. The other thing we do is we de-risk the startup phase as much as possible. So they can come in here with that idea and their laptop, and we provide everything else, 100 meg connections, and they don't need to sign up for a 2 or 3 year lease. It's a 2 month scenario. We can grow them into bigger, we can put them into bigger offices if they need to, or smaller offices if they're downsizing. So that flexibility and de-risking it. The other thing that we do, I think very successfully, is we connect the dots. So we're connecting talent with opportunities, with investors and capital.
Now, Josh, you mentioned an incubator called 2515 a minute ago.
I did.
Well, they aren't really an incubator like the ones we've been talking about. They are actually a private company that builds other companies.
It's a really interesting model. I went over to their space in Sydney a little while ago. It's a long room with a bunch of desks clustered in groups, people hunched over their laptops, beavering away on the 9 different companies they currently have going there.
What makes 2515 really different is that they begin the process before anyone even has an idea. Basically, they sit down with someone who has experience in a space that they don't, they brainstorm and have a chat, and maybe an idea for a new company will come out of that. Then they build it together.
Here's Kim Harris, one of the founders, taking us through it.
So it's like this idea of parallel entrepreneurship where we have shared resources that we apply across different projects. Not a lot of projects because we're super hands-on. We're co-founders in all of these businesses. So at most we can probably deal with 5 or 6 companies at any given time. And that's what we do. We build them. We take them from sometimes pre-idea through to prototype, product market fit, traction, scale, with a view to getting these businesses to exit.
So, there are quite a number of avenues to help tech entrepreneurs. You might not even need an idea.
As long as you know how to use Google, you can find a place to help you.
Well, it looks like I'm off to Google how to embezzle that money my rich auntie gave me. I mean, find an accelerator to give me a business plan.
Well, hold off for now. On the next episode, we're looking at co-working spaces, so maybe you'll prefer to invest in that. I'm Josh Nicholas.
And I'm Ellen Liebeder. Thanks for your company.
Next week, Josh and Ellen will step out and explore some co-working spaces in our next episode of Start Me Up. That's it for On The Money this week. Thanks to our reporters, Eliza Getze, Josh Nicholas and Ellen Liebeder. You can find all our podcasts at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Look for @onthemoney2ser, and you can find us on Facebook as well. I'm Catherine Zangara. Thanks for your company.